I see Caesar himself as a good illustration of a movement from a privatized religion into an acceptance of religion as a not only a social force, but also religion itself as being essentially social. That there's no way, and certainly in the New Testament, that we can come to the Lord except through and with others. Yet there's a strong tendency, particularly in the American ethic, to privatize religion, to make it a matter between God and myself, to save my soul. And this has affected the mainline Protestant churches and the Catholic Church in the United States. And I think it was in the 50s and 60s that you see a movement out of that into an acceptance of our social reality and of the centrality of that within religion. To me, that Caesar has been a very important figure in helping people see this and helping them to understand that there is no genuine and sincere religion that is completely privatized. Right now there's a tremendous effort to again reprivatize religion in the United States. I think it's a very dangerous thing and basically a very unchristian thing. But it certainly is subtle and it has a great attraction because the other, when you really get involved with the whole picture of society, it's a very tiring reality. It's a something that you wonder if you're making any headway, and it's very easy to withdraw into the quiet of the former relationship that you may have thought of as being very satisfying, and choosing Jesus as my personal savior, period, without realizing that you've got to relate that to the entire picture of Christ in the center of this world. The second thing that is very striking to me is, with Caesar, is that he has helped us out of a situation where we can easily settle for direct aid. When I was first sent up the valley, I was sent to Stockton, California, and there in San Joaquin County at that time we were receiving 30 to 40,000 migrant workers a year. Many of them were being sloughed off into Skid Row because their usefulness was no longer evident. And so we had a great problem of alcoholism, prostitution, dope traffic. And you are caught then with the realization that you've got to do something for these people. So you get into direct aid. And we started a dining room for the poor and a clinic. We had more doctors we could use. We had we bought housing for the transients. We got into a clothing depot, a food depot also for families. And you're so busy with that, and that's so important, that you feel this is it. This is the answer. And it's only when someone like Caesar or some of the others who preceded him at that time come along and say that's not the answer. You've got to be concerned about the cause for this poverty, this degradation, this suffering. To make that shift is a very difficult one. And it's very difficult for religious people to make it, because they can get so tied up and their time so taken, and they get so much praise and so much acceptance by the community, all the community really, as long as you don't do it in their area, that you just feel you don't have any energy to move on. Caesar, I think, was very helpful in making us realize that we had to move on. I remember when we made our first efforts there towards organizing, it was a little bit before Caesar came on the scene, but it worked right in with his own efforts to try to help our people, particularly the workers, realize that they had a right to organize, they had a right to bargain for a decent wage, for good conditions, work. You'd be amazed at the support you lose then for any of your direct aid, because your direct aid is coming from people who want things to remain as they are. And remember one man who was giving us food just called up and said, that's the end of it. He says, you got a bunch of no good bums down there, because they wouldn't work for the 40 cents an hour that was the going wage at that time. So Caesar, I think, served a great purpose in helping religious people see that if they're going to really respond to the needs of the poor, it has to be in a way that's in what we call development. Now, that's the role, I think, that he fulfilled very well, and he's still doing very, very well. I think he is helping religious people understand that you can't be simplistic in your approach. You've got to go on and try to take care of the cause of the poverty. Now, there is a problem that perhaps Caesar is facing at this time, and that many religious leaders are facing. Also, that second step has proven ineffective in many ways. And that is, of course, a very difficult stage to face when you come to see that you can't just remain with direct aid, you can't just get into development where you're starting to work for the rights of the worker and all of that, unless you also take a good look at the structures of society, of government, of the international corporation, all of these things now affecting our economy and the well-being of our country, and certainly directly affecting the poor at this time. I think that maybe that's the much more dangerous area, an area that I'm sure Caesar has been thinking of. He's been accused of being socialist or communist, the rest of it. But I do think that anyone who is dealing with these problems has to face that, not by falling into communism or socialism necessarily, but by really saying you can go as far as you want within the structures towards justice and peace, but there comes a time when you have to take a good look at the structures themselves. Are they immoral? And no matter what we might attain at this level, is it going to be frustrated, and are we going to have more suffering at the end? Not because this isn't a good movement, it's a wonderful movement, very important, but because the structures have tightened, as we've seen happen in our own United States. To me, that's one of the very serious problems we're facing now.
When Caesar was, some of the work that was going on in the 70s with getting the law passed here in California and so on, I guess I always kind of thought of that as a structural change. But I think I hear you talking about something that is more substantial.
Yes. I would see that as a good change within a good liberal society, mm-hmm. some of the changes that took place. But I do see also the unrestrained capitalism and the idea that it really is the free market. All of these things themselves have to be challenged. Yeah, I think what we have to start with is the human person. And in our thinking, are we starting with the human person, that a person born in the United States or comes here has the right to live decently, and that means the right to medical care, so forth. Of course, that person has an obligation to do what he or she can in the economy, but you start with the right, the basic right, which also entails an obligation. But you don't start with the idea that everyone has a right to make all the money they can, and then there'll be some kind of a trickle down to people mm-hmm. that are at the bottom. That means, of course, a rethinking of many of the structures, of not only nationally, but internationally. And I think that unless religious people at this time face that, they're not really facing the problem, the deep problem mm-hmm. that's affecting our people. This, of course, upsets your Catholics and your Protestants, or mainline Protestants in the United States, very much.
Yes.
But the leaders in both Protestant churches and Catholic churches have accepted that in many ways. You'll find the fundamentalists, of course, are shying away from it completely. Mm-hmm. I think the big challenge is, will the membership of both the mainline Protestant churches and the Catholic Church, will they be able to follow?
Does the new bishop's pastoral letter on the economy direct itself to that basic problem?
No, it doesn't. So not in any depth. The Bishop's Pastoral on the Economy is a very good letter, I think very helpful, within the context of what we call a good liberal approach in the United States, that you do have the obligation of taking care of people, and the government can't just shy away and mm-hmm. say that this is it. And it certainly goes along lines of a good, solid development theory. there's very little in there about structural change. Mm-hmm. The difference would be perhaps with the Canadian bishops, pastoral, which drew so much flack, as you know, which caused so much difficulty. There they did address, really, the structural reality. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a wise thing for the American bishops not to attempt it right now. Mm-hmm. I think it was wise for Caesar not to start there. Mm-hmm. I think you have to start where, in prudential judgment, where can we be of most help at this time? Mm-hmm. And can we open our people to come on gradually to see that you don't have the answer if you stop with one? Not that they don't mention the other. It is mentioned in the pastoral, but it's not treated mm-hmm. extensively. In fact, I haven't seen any good treatment of that coming from any religious group in the United States as of now. Mm-hmm. I think we've got some very fine letters from the World Council of Churches, the National Council of Churches, the bishops, both on war and peace, and on the economy. I think those are fine. But I do think that we've got to go further. And I think our leadership is surely not unaware of this. The thing is, how can you bring your people with you? How can you build a community with a conscience mm-hmm. and not just be out there in a prophetic way and then lose millions of people because they just can't understand it at this time?
Yes. Yeah, I have.
And I think the fear of socialism in the United States comes from a confusion which may be at times deliberately fostered by some. We've never really come to grips with what socialism is all about. Publicly, mm-hmm. We almost accept the Marxist line that socialism is a step towards Marxism, towards communism. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, we don't want to be tainted with it at all. We don't want to see its position. It's very interesting if we would really honestly address the situation in Canada, England, Belgium, Holland, France, Italy. All of those countries are really into a form of socialism. It may not be the perfect form. They've had trouble with it as they started. Now they've worked out of it a good deal. Even Margaret Thatcher is not able to dismantle the framework of socialism, which was accepted in England now for, 25 years. But we in our country are scared to death of this. We often will brand any kind of development as socialism, which is not the case at all. Development can be done within a liberal, purely capitalist society. Mm-hmm. And to really move out of that into some form of socialism, and I think that many people who are studying the situation in the Third World particularly see that even for the good of the United States itself, for its own survival, it really has to accept socialism, at least in other countries, as a very viable way to proceed. I remember under Somoza, I was in Nicaragua, and I met with some of the leaders of the business community. The head of Coca-Cola there at that time told me, he said, I can't see any possibility of this country ever surviving in any decent way without going to a form of socialism. This was the head of Coca-Cola. Which is rather strange to
quite surprising.
That's right. This was under Somoza, when Somoza was in power down there.
Mm.
So I do think this is in the works now, and I think Caesar's been very wise and very balanced in not coming out and speaking, about too much about structural change. Mm-hmm. He's doing a wonderful job within the context of development. And I think he's open certainly to structural change. And I think that I see that with many of the Protestant and Catholic leaders also.
Mm-hmm.
But how soon can we bring our people along to that? It's basically saying, I accept the human dignity of every last person on the face of the earth. They have a right to live, no matter where they're born, what their color is, what their condition. They have a right to live in decency. And our structure with regard to economic expression or political expression, the rest of it, has to take that into consideration. And if we don't, I feel we're drawing back into really a very immature stance of independence, as though we can remain independent of the rest of the world. And, even that isn't working for our own people. The latest findings, from the physicians that did the study came out a month and a half ago, telling us there are 10 million people in the United States that are really malnourished.
Mm-hmm.
really suffering. And so even in our own country, we're not taking care of that. Even imagine what impact we have in other countries when we take unrestrained profits from a country that's barely able to feed its people, or perhaps not able to feed them. Are we willing to go there? That's what I think Christianity has to face. Mm-hmm. And I think it will. I think we surely, I don't say we can come out and just recommend all kinds of dramatic changes if there's no chance of getting them through, but we have to start helping our people at least get the basis for those changes.
I think a lot of people who have followed the farm workers movement feel some sense of discouragement, mm-hmm. because people were drawn to the movement because it was so successful.
Yes.
It was able to make things happen, it was able to make things change. And then a point came where not so much changed anymore, which must also be very hard for Caesar and the leadership of the union to bear. But I think people do not want to see that reality, because it is tiresome.
It is, yes, very much so. Yes.
But and in some ways, I guess I as a Christian find it difficult to look at that movement in any way that separates it from my own religious observation of life and experience. Sure. But it seems to me that in some ways the union is at a point where those of us who have been supporters and those in the union that are people of faith really have a big spiritual struggle ahead.
Very true. And of course, hope is, I think, the key to that. Mm-hmm. What's the basis for our hope? And I think we have to keep this very much in mind. I think one of the Latin American theologians put it very well. He says, there's hope in this world because God has entered this world. There's hope in this world because God has entered this world through Jesus the Christ. There's hope in this world because God has entered this world through Jesus the Christ. Winders it through you and through me. And that's what we can't give up on. We don't do this alone. He doesn't do it alone. He does it through us and with us. And you do come to times of where you just feel we're not going anyplace, we're not getting the dramatic effects that we had, the results we had before. But, and I think we do need those, humanly speaking, we need to celebrate victories, of course. But to go on and say that we really are working towards the fullness of the kingdom of God is so important at times when you just don't see any breakthrough coming. And as long as we can develop our vision, and I think Caesar has been able to do that as a religious person. I think he's been able to develop his vision. So he is not, wiped out by the fact that there aren't these dramatic successes, but rather that there has been progress, great progress, and in spite of some of the temporary setbacks as with the present administration and all, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean that we have lost the battle. I think what it does say is that we've got to take full account of the social sciences even in our religious reflection, because the Word of God is certainly given us within a very clear context of society, and we have to ask ourselves not just what does the Word of God mean back 2,000 years ago, but what does it mean today? Mm-hmm. How does it come through? Not by manipulating it, but let it come through the reality that we see. And I think that reality is very clearly coming through to us now as something where sin has surely not only affected the individual, it's affected society through our prejudices, through our attitude towards poor and different people of different color. It's also sin has infected the structures under which we live, structures that will allow us to manipulate other countries, oppress them. And once we do it there, you're going to see that same kind of oppression reflected in your own country. And to overcome that, to face that from a religious viewpoint, that sin is not only personal, but it's societal, it's structural, I think is very important for us. And not to be discouraged, we're making progress. And the same with the union. It's done a tremendous amount of good. It's still doing good. And I think as society changes, many of its approaches will change. I hope it will. I see the Farm Workers Union as being very, very much in line with the basic freedom that all unions need, not to be caught into a system which itself can be sinful. Mm-hmm. It can happen to any union. And I don't see it happening to this union. I hope it will, never will. But they'll maintain the freedom to challenge even organized labor, mm-hmm. from the viewpoint of the person. Because the person is all important. It's not any structure, no matter what it is. It's the person. Mm-hmm. And if we can start with that and realize it's not just one person, it's every person. And I do see that realization coming more. And that's, I would hope that, it's, with Caesar, I came to know Caesar, I guess, was in the late 50s. He was working with Father McDonald in the fields. I forget when it was, he actually...
Was that in San Jose?
He was working on the sea. Father McDonald and two others were working in San Jose, and their work also took them up to Stockton at that time. And up in Stockton, we had started in the 50s, we had started to promote a dialogue between the growers and the workers. And we had help from some of the scholars from, I remember, Loyola Chicago was one center that helped us. Another was down in Los Angeles, Loyola, mm-hmm. Los Angeles. And then after some attempts there and some work, when Caesar came on the scene, I was able to, of course, meet him and work with him through much of the turmoil of the 60s, mm-hmm. and somewhat in the 70s. I kept in touch. But I certainly admire his work very much, and I feel it's, mm-hmm. it is succeeding, no matter what the people might like to report about. I think that there is a success that's there. It's not dramatic in the sense of the past.
Just when were you in Stockton?
I was in Stockton from 55 to 67. Then I moved to Oakland. And from there I kept in contact with the work, with some of the leaders that were organizing up in the Bay Area at that time.
Mm-hmm. And what was your assignment when you were in Stockton?
In Stockton, I was a pastor of the parish, downtown city parish near St. Mary's. And that's when we started the various works.
I heard about Father McDonald, who I do not know, from George Higgins. I met with George Higgins last Friday, in fact. Mm-hmm. And he looked him up in the directory, but couldn't find him. He might have had his name misspelled. Do you know where he is now?
He's at Our Lady of Guadalupe Church in San Francisco. He's pastor there. It's a Chinese parish by now, actually. It used to be a center for the Spanish-speaking, but it's practically all Chinese.
And is his first name Donald?
Donald, that's right, yeah. Donald McDonald.
George Higgins was saying that Father McDonald had been, as he recalled, had been very influential with Caesar in encouraging Caesar to work in the area of labor organizing.
Yes,
that's
right. Caesar used to go out with him to the camps and assist him when Father McDonald would go out and celebrate the Eucharist for the workers. Mm-hmm. Caesar would go out with him and often would read some of the readings of the scripture and so forth. Mm-hmm. And during that time, Father McDonald went through the papal letters on labor, mm-hmm. starting with Leo XIII and then Pius XI, acquainted, and the two of them then mm-hmm. became very well acquainted with the teaching.
How exciting.
Yes. That's when Caesar really started with him.
Is Father McDonald a Franciscan?
No, he's a diocesan. He belongs mm-hmm. to the Diocese of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Very fine, very.
Was that during the period when was Caesar working with CSO at that time?
I think so. I'm not. Yes, I'm. I think he was. I believe he was with CSO at that time. Mm-hmm. Out of San Jose, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm.
You've known the Chavez family for a long time?
No, I haven't been intimately related to them since, well, I guess I met them first through, trying to think of the time. I know Dolores Huerta for quite a while. She was in the parish in Stockton. That's where I came to know her.
Interesting.
Yes. But I had not known Caesar's family before. I would just guess about 1963 or 64. I met then, and I've been on and off, you know, in contact with them. Not as close as many others, like Father McDonald was closer to him.
So Caesar had a really strong religious interest that he that showed up quite early, that went along with his concern about the poor and about oppressed people.
That's right, yes. And a very strong devotional life. He really did believe, and he expressed his belief in prayer. This was very clear. And it wasn't just in moments of the show or anything else. As I say, it went from that kind of privatized religion of God and myself. I think very early in Caesar's life it went into this whole idea that, well, it's got to be expressed in my relationship to others, and what I'm doing for them. And as I say, many people never make that step. And that's where I think we're having a lot of difficulty, and especially in those days it was very difficult to show that that was, you know, something that should be preached from the pulpit and so forth. The idea was, well, just preach the gospel, don't preach any of that stuff, not realizing this is the gospel. But I really wouldn't know too much about his family life, except just from my own casual contacts that way. And of course then he went down to Delano. We did take over the parish in Delano after he was working down there. Franciscans are down there now.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Was Mark Day the first one that...
Well, Mark...
Was he a Franciscan?
Yes, Mark was a Franciscan. Mark was working in the camps in around Stockton. It must have been about 1964, 65. And in that way, he got in contact with Caesar and with the whole movement. And then he did move down also, and he worked for the Union. And then he moved to Los Angeles. He's writing there. He is.
Yes. I talked to. In fact, I sometimes cover events for the NCR he's going to be away or if he's got two that conflict from time to time.
Yes.
Not frequently, but I was at the Chrism Mass last night for him. There was some thought that perhaps the new cardinal might be named at the Chrism Mass last night. He was not. But it was a lovely service.
That was last night? Or
that was last night.
Last night. Yes.
That had been a parish there in Delano that had been supplied by the diocese up to that time?
Diocese, that's right.
And how does an order take over a parish?
A parish. Well, I was, by that time, I was the minister provincial for the Franciscans on the West Coast. And I negotiated with the diocese to take that on. We wanted to get it because of the Union being sent there. And you can ask a diocese, especially when they need help, you can tell them you will take a certain place. So, and of course, Caesar wanted us to take it in order that we'd be able to work closely with the people in the Union.
I'm trying to remember the name of that church. Is it, do you remember?
In
St. Mary?
Delano?
Yeah.
It's Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right. I think it is, yeah.
Okay. I think the other is St. Mary's, across the way, yes.
So, do you remember what year that was?
No, I'd have to check that out. It would have been after 67. Well, see, right about 67, I guess. Because I was on the board at that time. And it may have been even before I became provincial.
What diocese is that?
That's the Diocese of Fresno.
Up to that time, the two parishes there in Delano had been rather cool to the movement, as I recall.
That was my impression. I never did visit either of them, mm-hmm. asked or anything. Mm-hmm. But I think there was some difficulty there. I don't know just what it was.
In what ways have the Franciscans been involved with the farm workers movement over the years?
Well, I guess it did start in Stockton with the, as I say, the trying to get it organized there, and there was one of the organizers that came out from Chicago, I'm trying to think of his name, who started. We worked with him at that time before Caesar started. Mm-hmm. And then from then on, we took an active part with the farm ministry. We joined, and then we started
the National Farm Worker Ministry.
National Farm Worker mm-hmm. Ministry. We joined them, mm-hmm. and then we we took over. Let's see, Caesar's home parish in San Jose, mm-hmm. really Guadalupe there, and there we also worked with those who were at least related to the farm worker movement. That was one way in which we were able to foster it. Then we took over a parish in Fresno, which was again related. We had our difficulties there because one of the suburban areas of Fresno. We had, as I say, we had Mark working with the union at that time, Mark Day, mm-hmm. and we have kept in touch with the movement, giving talks in various places with regard to the boycotts that have come, and then also trying our best to have our own people who are working in the various agriculture areas come to grips with the need for the union. Mm-hmm. And I guess those would be the main ways.
By your own people, your own priests that are Franciscans.
Mm-hmm. That are working in various parts of the, you know, the West Coast too.
Yes.
And so they were quite active in the boycott.
This is very interesting to me because, of course, I always knew there knew certain individual Catholics that were in very key positions, like Leroy Chatfield and uh-huh. and you know, different ones that were very, very active as individuals.
Yes.
But in terms of corporate involvement of the Catholic Church, the part that I was most aware of uh-huh. was the work of the Bishops' Committee.
Oh yes,
which had a different role to play,
yes.
of
mm-hmm.
mediation and so on, mm-hmm. that was extremely useful to the
yes.
union, but. It's very interesting to me to hear about this different role that one part of the institutional uh-huh. church has played that was of a strongly advocating mm-hmm. Nature, it sounds like. Is that
yes,
accurate?
I think that would be correct. That, and of course, I suppose it came from realizing the great need there firsthand, working with the mm-hmm. farm workers. And then trying to, also in Arizona, we've worked somewhat in Arizona with the farm workers there, the union, trying to, again, have the growers come to grips with what's mm-hmm. happening. But it would be surely mostly here in California.
Mm-hmm.
Also, to some extent up in Oregon, we were able to do some work up there. Not much in Washington, because we didn't have any centers there on the mm-hmm. farm workers.
Mm-hmm. When you were in Stockton, and you mentioned that someone came out from Chicago, was that someone with IAF that did an organizer? Or
it was an organizer, but he was from, I think, AF of L at the time,
mm-hmm.
yes.
So from a labor
union. Yes, oh yes.
Mm-hmm. And was that part of the Agriculture Workers Organizing Committee effort?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So. Oh, you mean Caesar's group?
No.
Oh no.
No.
The
Filipino group.
Yes, I think that was connected mm-hmm. with them at that time.
And how did the Franciscans participate in that?
Well, we hosted the dialogue sessions for the workers and the growers to start with. We tried to get, and some of that was successful with one grower. Eventually was driven out by some of the others because he went along wholeheartedly for the union and insisted that he would take only union people and so forth. And so we had a very difficult time in the area. But it at least got people started to think, along those lines, to realize it. See, at that time, we were right in the middle of the Bracero program, which made it very difficult to unionize.
Yes. But see, that ended in 64, wasn't it?
That's 64. Right. Mm-hmm. Must be about that time. Mm-hmm.
So you hosted these sessions, and growers were willing to come because priests would be there, I suppose.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They weren't so anxious after a while. Our reputation was not very good with them after a few years. But some we kept friendly with, and some of them came along pretty well.
So do you think it was a benefit for growers to be able to hear what farm workers had to say?
Oh, I think so. I think, and also to hear what the church had to say about the morality of all the situation. And as I say, some did make a big change, particularly one grower there, and then some of the others I noticed came along pretty well. But it's a hard thing when money is involved to change a person's heart and have them see the whole picture.
Yes. How would you work with growers like when you went on down to Fresno and had a great many in that one parish? What were some of the ways that you used to try to meet them?
Well, I don't know as we were very successful in our methods. We were trying to at that time to preach, what the gospel really was all about, not to so much deliberately organize and all, but trying to get them to accept the basic concepts of what it means to be just and so forth. And then they knew that naturally that we were on the side of the workers, and so the tension was pretty strong at times. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's what you have to do is try to get them to come to grips with their own attitudes, if we can do that, in a positive way, not that they're the villains or anything else, but just to have them see that there is a side that we all have to take very seriously, that these are human beings, and that their rights are certainly prior to the rights of profit and consumerism and all the rest of it. That's not an easy thing to see.
No. And when the whole society is telling you that you really can be saved and do what you wish to do, not easy to come with an alternative message to that. Do you know what happened to the grower in the Stockton area who supported unionization?
He had to leave. He left the area.
He moved out of the area?
Yes, his folks had, I think, farmed there for almost 100 years.
Oh.
And he just had to pick up the bill. I don't know whatever did happen to him.
It's a very tragic story.
It was. A very sad thing.
And I don't suppose that any grower is unaware of the possibility of that happening.
That's right.
I'm sure much less now in this state than
sure
it was a few years ago.
In those days it was quite a thing.
Well, is there anything else that you would especially like to share with me about some of your own observations of Caesar as a person attempting to be very open in a certain way about his religious faith as a labor organizer?
Well, I think the great thing that Caesar has accepted about his faith is that his faith, first of all, is his faith, and he is not overly dependent upon others in the sense that he doesn't feel he's just a child and that he can't think for himself. Mm-hmm. I think he realizes that a mature Christian must make decisions before God, and as such, he has been very clear in searching for what really the Lord wants in this situation, and he hasn't just gone to others for answers, and I think that's very important. I think others can help us a great deal, give us insights at times, but if we don't stand before God in our conscience, I think we're in trouble, and I think he has done that very clearly. He's very respectful of church tradition, teaching, but he remains a person of real freedom, which is basic to Christianity. Mm-hmm. And that to me has been very, very inspirational, really, mm-hmm. to see that. I think he is a man of deep faith, and his personal religion is something that's very, very deep within him, but it's not a privatized religion in any sense. And I think that he really has reflected on some of the great figures in the history of the human race, Gandhi. He's very really taken by Gandhi's stand and Gandhi's whole relationship, which reflects very much of Christian thinking. Gandhi, of course, was very enamored of Christ and of the gospel. And also with Francis of Assisi was one of the men that Caesar feels very strongly attracted to and has tried to follow him, in the sense that Caesar's never been looking for his own aggrandizement and trying to get a lot of money and storing it away and all this kind of thing. He's tried to have the freedom which comes from not trying to make all the money. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's helped him a great deal at times when things get difficult. Mm-hmm. And I think of all the attacks have been made on him, that the one thing they can't accuse him of is being just a hypocrite who makes a display of his religion. I think that's very clear that there's no such thing there. Mm-hmm.
One last question that I have is, and I don't know that if you'll be able to respond to it or not. I interviewed Caesar in 77, mm-hmm. an interview for Sojourners magazine, mm. and he talked a great deal about his interest in developing the leadership of the Union as really as a religious community. Uh-huh. And I know that's been a very difficult task, and always
Surely.
A difficult task.
Oh, yes. Yes.
It probably could not be made any more difficult than it is by having, first of all, people who are interested in organizing labor
Sure. yes. uh-huh.
as their first commitment.
Yes.
Do you see any real viable possibility of Caesar being able to continue the leadership of the Union as out of the base of a kind of a religious community? With the kind of variety of people that have always been part of it.
Yeah, it's hard. I know Chris Hartmeyer mm-hmm. wrote to me about that, and we shared what insights we had on that. But I really can't say. My concern about forming a religious community is that you've got to be very, very careful not to, first of all, overstructure it. Let it remain a movement that is deeply religious, but don't try to make it into a structure. There has to be some structure, but be very careful. And I think that's the danger. I don't know how you can organize a movement like this and have it continue on with its trust, dedication, without, in a sense, overstructuring.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, then you're going to exclude many people that would be very, very good in this world, very helpful. And so I don't know. I think you might have a movement growing out of the movement, put it that way, that would be very deeply religious and committed to very clear religious observance. But it certainly would be a tremendous challenge. See, the Third Order of St. Francis was a movement something like this in the 13th century, where lay people, married people, joined the order and stayed in their professions. And they did have a tremendous effect on, of course, they say the feudal system really mm-hmm. collapsed because of the impact, mm-hmm. the fact they would not take up arms. And there were many things that happened because of the religious movement at the time. It never did structure very tightly, and as a consequence, it stayed on. It has maybe 1 million members today in the world, but it is not the forceful movement that it was at one time. It's, you know, it can get into a privatized religion at times. Mm-hmm. Various. You have to watch all those things naturally as you go along.
Mm-hmm.
That's my would be the closest experience I've had. But then you still find the. They call it now the secular order of Franciscans. You still find them individuals and groups that are very, very dynamic and very dedicated and really do a tremendous amount of good in some countries.
That's very interesting. Well, I certainly do appreciate your taking time to meet with me.
Oh, I'm very happy to have you.
This afternoon, I'm going down to Carpinteria. I